I asked Dr. Grelo to comment on the ASCO cardiac safety papers and Dr. Dresner's patient.
It's early for an anthracycline-related cardiomyopathy to present. It's not unheard of. Her diabetes would give her a higher risk. And risk factors for general cardiac disease are also risk factors for chemotherapy and trastuzumab-related cardiac toxicity, so hypertension and diabetes.
Well, this one was normotensive, but she did have diabetes.
Yeah.
So I thought we could just keep this case in the back of our mind and mainly just talk about ASCO and kind of go back and forth from this case. What was your take on the cardiac data that were presented about the anthracyclines at ASCO?
Yeah, I mean, cardiomyopathy is real. It's clearly higher in anthracycline-containing regimens. And, you know, depending on how you define it, it's as high as a couple percent if you follow patients out long-term. And that was really borne home by long-term follow-up studies from MD Anderson and NCI Canada. I think that the take-home message is we really need to be careful when we're only offering a couple percent improvement in survival, that we are weighing that couple percent improvement in low-risk patients with some real cardiac toxicity. It's rare, but if you're only giving a couple percent survival advantage, you have to subtract out any serious toxicities like congestive heart failure and acute leukemia as well.
When you have counseled patients in the past prior to ASCO, what number would you give them? Let's assume a patient like this, because I don't think it's that uncommon. 60-year-old patient who has either hypertension or diabetes, in this case diabetes, what kind of number would you give for cardiomyopathy as a risk factor for adjuvant doxorubicin in this situation? And did that number change after ASCO?
Right. So for 60 milligrams per meter squared times 4, given this was an every 2 week, although follow-up on the CLGB9741 really shows no difference for every 2 week versus every 3 week. You know, I would have quoted a 1% or less chance of a symptomatic cardiomyopathy. And I don't think we have a good handle on what drops in ejection fraction are that fall in an asymptomatic range. After ASCO, I'd have to bump it up a little bit with long-term follow-up. It could be as high as a couple percent, even with this 240 per meter squared, especially bumping up to 360 per meter squared as they've used in some of these studies. I think the big message for me related to this is that the diabetes in this case might have been something that was a tip-off. Clearly hypertension and other risk factors for cardiac disease in general are risk factors for chemotherapy-related heart toxicity. And although everything was done correctly here, the ejection fraction was checked ahead of time, the doses were not unusual, they were standard doses, the cumulative dose was quite low, this does show that occasionally it can happen in an average person without a lot of risk.
Can you talk a little bit about what we know about the clinical course of anthracycline-related cardiomyopathy, particularly in this situation, adjuvant therapy of breast cancer? And again, did you learn anything more about that at ASCO that you think was important?
I'm not sure that what I learned at ASCO changed my thinking about what happens in terms of the time course. It generally doesn't present while patients are on therapy. Asymptomatic drops in ejection fraction certainly do, but symptomatic congestive heart failure usually happens out after the chemotherapy is done. It can be a couple years out, longer than that, even out 7 years. But I don't think that I saw anything that would tell me differently at ASCO in terms of the timing of the symptoms. And it'll be interesting to watch what happens as we're now following ejection fractions more often. We know from the trastuzumab trials that there's a lot of drop in ejection fraction going on just with AC times 4 that prevented people from going on to the taxane trastuzumab part of the trial, even in the intergroup trials.
What's your practice in terms of who do you do pre-treatment ejection fractions on? Again, HER2 negative.
I generally do it if somebody's over 60. I don't routinely do it younger than 60 if there are no other risk factors. That's a little bit variable. I do talk to patients about the risk of cardiac toxicity, and sometimes patients are interested in knowing where they're starting, so it's not a fine cut at 60. But in general, if anybody's over 60, I will always get an ejection fraction.
And again, assuming the patient is fine, do you then repeat it?
I don't repeat an ejection fraction in an asymptomatic patient unless they're on trastuzumab.
You know, it's interesting, even though it's unusual, again, 1% was the figure, now maybe it's 2%. It's interesting when you ask breast cancer patients, and we did some town meetings a couple years ago with breast cancer patients. We gave them keypads and had researchers present issues to them. And one of the things we asked them was, what level of concern do you have about A, B, C, D, E, F, G side effects of chemo, adjuvant chemo? And interestingly, even though it's very uncommon, they rated the risk of cardiomyopathy one of the highest adverse things, the things they didn't like.
I mean,
it's kind of intuitive, I guess, but it was just interesting that they picked up on that, even though it's very uncommon. Any thoughts about non-anthracycline regimens, particularly in the node-negative patients? And again, have these data made you rethink your choice of chemo in the node-negative patient?
Well, I'd sure like to not have to give an anthracycline. Clearly, the myelodysplasia, acute leukemia, and congestive heart failure is real, especially in a node-negative patient who is getting a small benefit from the chemo. I think we have some nice ongoing studies looking at replacing anthracyclines. I'm not a huge fan of CMF, although some of my colleagues still feel there's a time and a place. I think we have lots of trials that suggest that there are some better regimens for the group as a whole. There's probably a subpopulation that does just fine with CMF, but I also wonder if that's not a group that does just fine with endocrine therapy alone as well, especially with better endocrine therapy. So the CALGB 49907 trial looking at AC versus paclitaxel, not added together, but just one or the other, and it's 4 versus 6 cycles. I think that's an important study. Could you just give a taxane in a node negative or 1 to 3 node positive population? And in the older population, women over 65, HIMUS is running another CALGB trial looking at AC or CMF, your choice, if that's what you're randomized to, versus capecitabine as a single agent in the adjuvant setting in women over 65. I think those are great studies that, especially in the lower risk group, may prove that a single agent that doesn't have a lot of the CHF and the leukemia risk could be substituted.
I'd like to pick up on both of those studies. I think they're really interesting, innovative studies. Now, the first study that you mentioned in node-negative patients, I believe the AC is given dose-dense, even though it's only AC.
Right. The AC and the paclitaxel are given dose-dense every 2 weeks with growth factors. Correct.
Well, I guess I should backtrack and say, what is your usual regimen in node-positive patients?
In node-positive, off-study,
right.
I actually am a fan of dose-dense AC paclitaxel. You know, SWOG has a lot of experience with metronomic dosing, and so I do use that in very high-risk, locally advanced patients neoadjuvantly.
And actually, we know that both in clinical researchers as well as community docs right now, dose-dense is by far and away the most common regimen. A lot of those docs do say they use dose-dense AC in node-negative patients without the taxane. Do you do that?
I have done it because you get done faster, and there's really no significant increase in myelotoxicity when you add the growth factor. But frankly, if I feel strongly enough that a patient really needs chemotherapy, I'm usually being pretty aggressive. It's interesting to play it all out on Adjuvant Online, for example.
Right.
You know, the first generation versus the third generation regimens do. Usually in a node negative, ER positive or lower risk patient, you aren't getting much benefit from the first generation, and you can't really make a case until you go to the third generation. So I don't give just plain old AC without a taxane all that often anymore, looking at all the trials that have come out. I don't think it's inferior to give it dose dense. I think you get it done sooner, but I'm not sure that it improves the efficacy either. It may be all in the taxane.
You know, it's interesting. What I hear is that people start seeing people, quote, sail through dose dense, and then they start to see their non-dose dense AC patients having more trouble. Really, it seems like it's a totally side effects, toxicity, quality of life, getting through quickly, nothing about, you know, hopefully it'll be efficacy, but more on that basis. I guess the big thing about using the Q2 weeks and the growth factor is the cost and I guess side effects of Neulasta. What do you see incidentally in terms of side effects of dose-dense, specifically the Neulasta?
You get some joint and muscle aches and pains, and we've known that. Overall, the patients are on treatment about a month less, though, and so most of them want to keep going, even though they recognize that the addition of the growth factor is causing them some symptoms. Occasionally, a patient will question it or have a lot of problems, and we start a nonsteroidal and try to help get them through it.
What do you see in terms of post-chemotherapy fatigue? Once they get to the very end of their chemotherapy, generally how they feel, fatigue, how long it takes them to recover, dose-dense AC versus non-dose-dense AC, dose-dense AC paclitaxel versus non-dose-dense?
I think while patients are on treatment, the dose-dense does catch up a little bit. So there is a bit more fatigue. And post-treatment, when they're in the recovery phase, I don't see a huge difference just kind of subjectively in the recovery phase. Their patients are variable, and there are some patients who have 90% of their energy level back within a month or two, and then there are others where a year later they're still saying, you know, that they're 10 to 20% below their baseline before we started chemo. Who knows how much of that is related to putting them through menopause, and you know, I treat a lot of young women, and that clearly has an impact as well. I haven't seen a huge difference, Neil, in adding a taxane or not in terms of the recovery time once you're done with the chemo. Actually, I think some patients start recovering a little bit when they stop the anthracycline and start the taxane. A lot of my patients say they're already starting to feel a bit better.
Interesting. Mm-hmm. The other trial you mentioned was the study looking at capecitabine versus AC and CMF. What do you think that study is going to show, assuming it gets done and we get enough events, et cetera?
Well, that study is actually accruing fairly well compared to the other study that isn't accruing quite as well. So it will get done. You know, initially, the capecitabine dose was a full dose, and there were two very early deaths in the study on the capecitabine, one that clearly looked like a DPD deficiency and the other that probably was, although a little bit longer until the symptoms developed. At that point, some safeguards were put in, and we were allowed to reduce the dose. And we have not had a problem with deaths or real serious issues subsequently. I don't know what it'll show. I mean, capecitabine is a single agent in the metastatic setting. It's a great drug, so it could win. And in terms of the long-term toxicities, this is an older population, so I think the patients who receive the AC will have some cardiac toxicity and even potential leukemia that will show up during their lifetime. We're all living so long now that women who are 65 could have three decades still. So I don't know. I mean, the trial is designed to look at superiority of capecitabine, and it has a real chance of showing that, but the study will tell us.
Now, how many people have you put on that study yourself, roughly?
Personally, I've put on three or four.
And have any of them been randomized to capecitabine?
Yeah.
And what's it been like to give capecitabine in the adjuvant setting? I mean, I guess it's like metastatic disease, but I'm just kind of curious.
Well, it's all the discussion about the oral agents and making sure that they really understand that they need to take the drug and they shouldn't be skipping drug. We also, especially with those two early deaths that were seen in the study early on, were really counseling about, just like we would in the metastatic setting, reporting diarrhea early, diarrhea that starts within the first week after you start taking the drug can't be ignored, and you really have to consider the possibility that the patients do have an enzyme problem there that's going to cause real toxicity from the capecitabine. Patients like taking an oral drug, and they like not losing their hair. And there's really not a lot of nausea with it. You know, I mean, we've had lots of experience with it in the metastatic setting. So I have found good acceptance. I think there will be some patients who find that coming into the infusion room and spending a few hours there every 2 or 3 weeks is very helpful, especially after a new diagnosis. They get some support from the chemo nurses and maybe other patients that are in the clinic. And for some patients, there's bonding that goes on and education that goes on that they would miss if they were just coming in for blood draws and clinic visits every 3 weeks. So I think oral agents will be right for some patients, and IV agents will be right for others.
I'm curious what you project as the psychosocial impact of utilizing adjuvant capecitabine compared to IV, AC, or CMF. In the metastatic setting, a lot of these women have had chemotherapy in the past, so they've already been through the experience. They might have even had it in metastatic disease. Now you're looking at first-time exposure. It just seems like the whole experience would be so different to walk out of there with a prescription for a drug that's not going to cause nausea and hair loss compared to just even four cycles of AC. And that's a huge life-altering experience.
Absolutely. You know, we tie in nutrition visits. My physician's assistant will frequently go up and see the patient when they're sitting in the chair. So we'll have to find other ways of giving that kind of attention and education and just backup to the patients. It might be that we do need to schedule a separate social work or nutrition appointment, you know, with the every 3 week visits when they're coming in for their blood tests so that they feel a little bit more of that collegiality, that, you know, the support from the ancillary crew too.
You said that you don't usually use AC or CMF alone, But in those patients in whom you would have, if this capecitabine study, let's say, even shows equivalence, do you think you would utilize it in younger women or continue just in the older patients?
I'm much more likely to use a gentler chemotherapy regimen in older patients. So although I make the leap in patients who have some comorbidities or a little bit lower performance status to substitute capecitabine, I'm not sure that without further study comparing it to anthracycline taxane, for example, that I'd be willing to make a big leap there in my younger patients.
You know, it's interesting because if you look at colon cancer in terms of adjuvant therapy, obviously the standard is FOLFOX, but there are data that now show that capecitabine is equivalent. Actually, it's probably better than 5-FU alone, so that now is an option. And it's interesting to think about the low-risk colon patient, looking at FOLFOX versus capecitabine for maybe a 1% or 2% benefit, kind of like AC versus AC taxane, you know, minimal benefit. And you wonder, maybe there would be people out there who would say, well, you know, it's only a 1% or 2% benefit. Instead of, you know, wrecking my life and losing my hair, maybe I'll just, but I want to do something.
Mm-hmm.
You know, maybe it would play out that way. It'll be interesting to see.
It will be, especially a group that might really prefer that would be somebody who wants to keep working the whole time and doesn't want to lose the hair because they don't want people to know they're on treatment and doesn't want the long chemo infusion room appointments. I think it's an interesting option. And I'm optimistic that it'll be a choice anyway for some of our patients in the near future.
It's just frustrating for docs in practice to have to wait to get the results of adjuvant trials. I mean, I don't know, what is this going to be, 3 or 4 years, or when do you think you'll get some answers?
Yeah, I think we're thinking we'll meet accrual within a year, but then we actually are doing so much better in terms of event rates. We have less recurrences and deaths due to early detection and better treatments, and a lot of those women on this trial will go on good endocrine therapy as well. So the event rates are taking much longer, and each trial as it's designed is falling short of its event rate, too, which is a good thing for patients, but it is a bit frustrating. Another big barrier that's gotten even worse right now in terms of getting trials done is that the NCI budget is going negative, and we don't have the money for the big cooperative group trials that you need to really do the phase three practice-changing kinds of trials. And it can take us a couple of years from the time a concept is submitted to make an agreement about a trial, and some very good trials are currently being rejected right now, or they're being stalled because we don't have the funding right now. It's not a good thing. And luckily in breast cancer, we do have some other resources with respect to private foundations and the Department of Defense. But, you know, the pharmaceutical companies are an important component in the development of all these new drugs, but there are certain trials that they are never going to be interested in funding, especially with drugs that are off patent that might be cheaper.
Yep, it's a problem. I feel my blood pressure increasing, incidentally, as I listen to you. That and false negative ERs are the two things that get me the most upset. But anyhow, I'm curious, in terms of the issue of a non-anthracycline adjuvant chemotherapy, what you thought about the TC presentation that Steve Jones from US Oncology did at the last San Antonio meeting?
I've never given TC. If you really believe the toxicity data as it was presented, which I'm sure was accurate, the TC wasn't substantially more toxic than the AC. I was surprised that the neutropenia rates and all weren't much higher. So I think that if I were going to give AC to somebody, TC would be a reasonable alternative. They're pretty striking results, actually.
I mean, what were your take on the efficacy data that were presented specifically?
Yeah. There was not a survival advantage that was significant.
Right, but there was a disease.
But there was a disease-free survival advantage, and it was, I thought, clinically relevant.
Yeah, it was substantial.
Yeah.
I think it was in the 30% range.
Mm-hmm.
Have you used TC at all?
I haven't used TC, so I don't have a feel for the toxicity. And, you know, my gut feeling would say it is going to be more toxic, maybe in ways that don't show up as grade 3, 4 events, but I haven't used it yet.
More toxic in terms of quality of life issues. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I guess the other thing is going back to the cardiac issue. I don't know how much that's going to play into your mind.
I think that'll be real important. You know, the TC might not have the cardiac toxicity.
Going back to ASCO, Can you talk about the two papers that you did a discussion on at ASCO related to bone?
So we saw the 5-year bone density substudy of the ATAC trial, which was very interesting. We've been following the fracture rates on that trial for a while, and they're about 11% at 68 months of follow-up in the anastrozole arm and about 7.5% in the tamoxifen arm. But the question that I think that we're really trying to get a hold of is who should get the bisphosphonates up front versus later? How often should we follow bone density studies? And I do think that this ASCO study that Rob Coleman presented, the ATAC bone density study, showed that not everybody needs every year DEXA scans and not everybody needs an upfront bisphosphonate. What was surprising to me but very reassuring was that if you started the ATAC trial with a normal bone mineral density, so a T-score of better than -1, none of those patients after 5 full years of treatment and follow-up were actually osteoporotic. About 50% had gone into an osteopenic range. We would have expected about a 2 to 3% bone loss during that time just based on aging. But clearly compared to tamoxifen, that 50% being osteopenic compared to about, I think it was 15 to 20% with tamoxifen who had gone from normal to osteopenic.
Which I think is interesting.
That some of the tamoxifen patients did anyway. Well, that's, you know,
normal. We always think that tamoxifen and bone, but yet some of these women lost bone in spite of it.
Right. It's not perfect either. Aging happens even to the best of us. What I think that shows is that if you started with a normal bone mineral density, you don't need an every year DEXA scan, and you don't need an upfront bisphosphonate, because your chance after 5 years of an aromatase inhibitor of becoming outright osteoporotic was zero on that study.
And what happens to those women who do lose bone after 5 years? Does it come back or does it stay the same?
Well, that's a good question, because we don't have the longer term. We're looking at that at the kind of 72-month follow-up and don't really have that data. There was some early data that I think Per Lonning presented last year at ASCO, or maybe the year before even, that suggests a little rebound after you stop the AI. And that might make some sense. You'd go back to your baseline aging. The question always is, in a study like that, you have to keep careful track of who initiated an intervention and throw those people out, because if they bounce back due to a bisphosphonate, that's not the same thing.
Well, also, I think that the fracture rate starts to come together after 5 years, which is sort of surprising, but supposedly not surprising. I mean, you can tell me, is that surprising?
Yeah. Well, the annual rate of fracture does start to even out again after you're off of the drug.
So it's that quick?
Within a couple of years.
What I'm saying is the relationship between bone density and fracture can happen that quickly.
With, you know, about 2.5 years of follow-up on the IES study, there was a strong trend in the big 198 trial with letrozole up front compared to tamoxifen. Within about, I think it's 26 months or 28 months was the first reporting, there was also already a difference in fracture.
So it's a rapid phenomenon.
Right.
What about the people who lost bone?
So for people who came in osteopenic, it was surprising that it was still only around 10 to 15% of them who became osteoporotic after a full 5 years. So that's also somewhat reassuring. You know, in general, if you were on the AI, you lost more bone density. And in general, actually, you gained a little bone density for the group as a whole if you were on tamoxifen. I think it's going to be interesting to put this, the bone density, into the whole context of now the survival advantage that we're starting to see for the switching studies that we have yet to see for the head-on comparisons of tamoxifen versus an AI, both the IES study and the ARNO 95 study that switched after a couple of years of tamoxifen to either anastrozole or exemestane versus continuing on tamoxifen, have now a significant p-value for survival.
Were you at the Oxford overview meeting this past year? Because I saw a couple slides that Richard Gray did of some type of back-of-the-envelope type meta-analysis of the published AI trial showing if you put it all together, there is a survival advantage. Going back to bone, what's your own practice in terms of when you're going to use an AI, you do the bone mineral density, how do you then move forward in terms of whether to use a bisphosphonate and which one?
Well, it's all based on the bone density. If they have a T-score of -2, which would be a significant osteopenia, that's usually a range, if I'm starting an AI, that I would start a bisphosphonate. I'll certainly try calcium and vitamin D and recommend weight-bearing activity. And some women want to try that for a year and see what it gets them. And that's fine if they're not already in an an osteoporotic zone and they weren't doing those things. So lifestyle interventions for sure. A bisphosphonate frequently if their T-score is -2 or worse.
Which one?
You know, good question. You know, the hip fracture is what we're most worried about, but the spine is where you get more fractures. So occasionally you have a conflict between what the two are showing. I tend to take the worst of the two if I have a -2 in either, because when I watch my colleagues in radiology do the DEXA and watch how the machines calculate it and all, there's certainly room for error there. And we know that they can go up and down if you follow them annually and kind of reverse themselves.
If you can use a bisphosphonate in that situation, which one would you use?
You know, right now, if you ask me, like in clinic today, the abandronate at 150 milligrams monthly is interesting to patients, the monthly dose. I think alendronate certainly has long-term follow-up data. There are a variety out on the market that you can give weekly now.
In your experience, when you have people with osteopenia like that who are receiving a bisphosphonate in an AI, do they tend to lose more bone, gain bone, or what happens?
You know, some people stabilize. Occasionally, you'll see them increase bone density. And some people tend to lose a little bit with each DEXA that you do, but they stay out of the osteoporotic zone. It varies, just like it does in somebody not on an AI, too.
So today, or if you see a patient in clinic today who has normal bone density that you're going to start an AI, and they say, is my chance of fracture going to be increased because of taking this medication? How would you answer it?
Well, I'd say that at this point, we know that there is an increased fracture rate from taking the drug, but that we can sort out populations that have higher and lower risk, and that she would be somebody that wouldn't have a high risk. You know, that's interesting because that's different from what the ASCO bisphosphonate guideline says. We published that last in 2003, and we said any woman on an AI would be considered high risk and should actually have DEXAs yearly. We said the same thing for anybody who had premature menopause related to their treatment. And we kind of lumped them together. And I think what this ATAC bone density study would show us is that as we're writing this summer, the update ASCO guideline, which is happening, we have to rethink that annual DEXA scan in women on AIs. Because I think if you start with a normal bone density, every 2 years is probably fine. You might want to check it a year to see if it's somebody who has a really high exceptionally high rate, but I'm not sure you need that. I think we can back off on the frequency of DEXAs in women on AIs who start with a good bone density.
It's interesting. So, and you're saying that that's about two-thirds, or at least two-thirds of the women on the ATAC trial had normal bone density. Is that your experience in general in practice, or what do we know about, in general, women presenting with breast cancer in terms of the incidence of normal, you know, the fraction of normal bone density versus osteoporosis, osteopenia?
Yeah, I mean, the average woman would be about 62. I see a very young population, so in my clinical practice, you know, I have women with good, strong bones to start with, but I put a lot of them through menopause, so we impact that quickly. I actually, Neil, would have to go back and look at what the numbers would be for the average 62-year-old. Women who get breast cancer, interestingly, there's some data that suggests they have better bone density than the average population, maybe having something to do with the estrogen exposure effect.
Right.
The bones are better, but the breast cancer risk is a bit higher.
Right, that makes sense. So has this new data changed your perception of the tolerability and safety profile of tamoxifen versus an AI in postmenopausal women?
Well, I think we know how to manage bone density. I think that the fracture rates that we're seeing on all of these aromatase inhibitor versus tamoxifen trials are probably reflective of women who weren't closely followed, who didn't have bisphosphonates, who didn't, in general, on the ATAC trial, and even on the bone density trial, they didn't even recommend calcium and vitamin D. They didn't prohibit it outright, but they didn't recommend it. I think we don't know what those kinds of interventions will do. So I'm not as worried about the bones, although it's definitely something we have to pay attention to. And if somebody gets started on a bisphosphonate, it then makes the expense that much higher. I'm interested in also following out the whole lipid issue and the cardiac issue. Again, we do have interventions for cholesterol if it becomes a problem. But time will tell how many patients end up going on a statin, for example, because they're on an aromatase inhibitor versus tamoxifen. It may just all be that tamoxifen lowers the LDL and raises the HDL, and it's not that the AI itself is raising it, But tamoxifen has some of its side effects are good. You know, with these switching studies now being the first to show the survival benefit, I question whether or not tamoxifen shouldn't be in some way, shape, or form included along with an AI at some point in the whole regimen.
I wanted to sort of do a quick tour of ASCO. Mm-hmm. And if you had to pick the two or three things that stand out in your mind in terms of breast cancer presented at ASCO, what would you say?
Well, number one would have to be the lapatinib data.
Yep.
There was a surprise. We didn't expect to see it at ASCO, but the phase 3 capecitabine plus minus lapatinib trial in patients who had already had anthracycline, taxane, and trastuzumab, you know, it was closed early by the Data Safety Monitoring Board at an interim analysis because it had met its pre-specified endpoints for early stopping, a doubling in the time to progression by adding lapatinib in patients, 98% of whom had already progressed on trastuzumab, an increase in the response rate. I mean, really some powerful data and an option for patients whose tumor has already grown through trastuzumab. There were also abstracts looking at oral presentation by Nancy Lin looking at brain metastases. Lapatinib is oral and it's a small molecule and it has potential to cross the blood-brain barrier. So this was a trial looking at brain mets from breast cancer. And they had a couple of dramatic responses. It's a proof of principle trial. We'll need to follow it out. Neil Spector presented an abstract looking at recurrent or refractory inflammatory cancer that showed promise there.
With lapatinib,
HER2 positive. And then Edith Prez reviewed all the data on lapatinib-treated patients with breast cancer or other cancers for cardiac toxicity. And symptomatic cardiac toxicity on the 38,000-some people who have been treated with lapatinib for cancer was 0.1% symptomatic. And a drop in EF, and these were closely followed by MUGAs on all of these trials, a drop in EF of 20% or greater was 1.2% of all the patients in these trials. So the cardiac signal might be weaker than with trastuzumab, although time will tell.
What about side effects and toxicity?
Well, it's a dual HER1 or EGFR and HER2 tyrosine kinase inhibitor. So you do get some of that EGFR inhibition effect, like a little bit of diarrhea and rash. The dose that was used for the combination capecitabine-lapatinib trial was lower than single agent dose. It was 1250 daily orally. And the capecitabine dose was actually only 2000 in a split dose, 2 out of 3 weeks, which is a nice precedent for future trials with biologics. We don't have to start at 2,500 anymore of the capecitabine. There was a little bit more diarrhea, just a teensy bit more hand-foot syndrome and skin toxicity at that dose of 1250 in combination with capecitabine. I don't know that the HER1 or EGFR inhibition does anything in breast cancer, so it's kind of maybe pulling in some side effects related to the EGFR inhibition that aren't needed because the EGFR inhibition doesn't maybe make a difference in breast. But really, it seemed to be quite well tolerated when you head on compared the toxicities in somebody already on a chemo agent.
Has lapatinib been looked at in women with HER2-negative tumors?
It was. In the inflammatory trial that Neil Spector presented, there were two cohorts, and there was an arm where you didn't have to be positive, and that arm really didn't show a response at all.
What do you see as the next step with lapatinib, both in clinical research and clinical practice?
Well, an expanded access program has already been initiated for patients who've already had anthracycline, taxane, and trastuzumab. The approval is moving along through the FDA, and it could be approved in the not-too-distant future. And I think studies looking at lapatinib in combination with trastuzumab will be very important. Preclinical data suggests that there's synergy there. They work by very different mechanisms on the HER2 molecule, and so they really could add. The next intergroup adjuvant trial will use as a backbone an AC paclitaxel chemo regimen, and one arm will get the year of trastuzumab, one arm will get both added together, and then the third arm that's under negotiation is lapatinib alone without any trastuzumab in the adjuvant setting.
Yeah, I've been hearing about that from Edith Prez, and after the Herceptin data came out, you really wonder about that arm without the Herceptin.
I entirely agree, actually. I have polled some of my patients and some of my colleagues and asked them if they'd feel comfortable with that arm. In Seattle, there is a discomfort. They'd like at least maybe 9 weeks per that Finnish HER2 study that showed that 9 weeks had some benefit in the adjuvant setting. Ethically, I don't think it's an inappropriate arm. I think that what will reassure us is head-on comparison data of the two drugs in the metastatic setting. And if they're looking fairly equal, then I think it will be easier to accrue.
So that was in refractory patients. I guess what you'd love to see would be upfront.
Absolutely.
Trastuzumab alone. Is that going to get done?
That will be done. Interestingly, you know, last year, before all, you know, the big exciting break in this big trial, we were advising that we really needed that to push it as a single agent into the earlier stage setting. You know, upfront single agent lapatinib has been done in patients who haven't received trastuzumab in other parts of the world where trastuzumab is not readily available. And the response rates and time to progression there as a single agent compared virtually identically. I mean, they're historical controls and you take it with all those caveats, but the response rate and time to progression were virtually identical to that seen when trastuzumab was used as a first-line single agent. Chuck Vogel had published on that years ago. So good activity as a single agent, comparable to that previously seen with trastuzumab. We need the comparison, and it might be that that has to be done in other parts of the world, that we can't do it here because we can get ready access to the trastuzumab.
What else happened at ASCO that you think is important for oncologists in practice to know about?
Besides lapatinib, the aromatase inhibitors continue to be an evolving story, with now the first survival differences being reported. I think the IES and the ARNO-95 trial, that's important data, that a switch shows a benefit. And then the question is the switch really better? Is there priming, or is it because the two drugs are not totally cross-reactive in terms of resistance? I don't know.
Or, you know, is it a more favorable group of patients that you're looking at who make it to 2 years, mm-hmm. who are more endocrine responsive?
Correct. All of those are potential reasons that we're seeing it first in the switching setting. Again, we saw an update of the data on the MA17 trial for that group that had originally, after 5 years of tamoxifen, been randomized to placebo as opposed to letrozole. And then in about 30 months, when the study became unblinded, they were offered letrozole. About two-thirds of them chose the letrozole. They tended to be a higher risk group, more positive nodes, et cetera. And following those people out over time who had that average of a 30-month gap without any endocrine therapy, it's fascinating to see that even with that gap, and even those women now being a good 8 years from their diagnosis, there is a reduction across the board in every type of breast cancer recurrence, contralateral, you know, in-breast, distant. It's really pretty impressive. And that, we first saw that at San Antonio just in December, but really, it did make me turn around and talk to some of my patients and at least offer them the option if they'd been off of everything for a couple of years, especially if they were high risk of going back on an endocrine agent again.
So how long off tamoxifen would they have to be, or how long past the diagnosis would you get to a point where you think it's too? I mean, you saw somebody who was treated 10 years ago, for example. Would you bring it up?
Probably not. In a 10-year patient, there might be some benefit there. But since it was about a 30-month duration off therapy in the MA17 trial, I kind of used 3 years on average as an interval off that I would bring it up. Who knows? That's arbitrary, but you have to pick some time period.
Well, the other related unanswerable question at the moment is whether to stop the AI at 5 years. What are you doing?
Eric Weiner gave a very nice discussion at ASCO about that issue, based entirely on modeling and no clinical trial data, following out what the rate of recurrence is expected to be in people off therapy over time using a lot of the Oxford Overview and other data. He actually stated in his discussion that he believes that probably 5 years, even after a couple years of tamoxifen, would be the right thing. He led our ASCO tech assessment on aromatase inhibitors and really didn't jump on the bandwagon for aromatase inhibitors up front. So he gave that a lot of thought, and his discussion made a lot of sense.
So at this point, when you have a patient who gets the 5 years, are you stopping them?
5 years total or 5 years of an AI?
Either one.
The answer is if it's 5 years of an upfront AI, which I'm just starting to come up on now, I'm stopping them unless they strongly desire continuing it. And that's usually in the setting of having 10 positive nodes. And although if they had 10 positive nodes and they haven't recurred after 5 years, I think their recurrence risk has dropped substantially. Interestingly, the MA17 re-randomization trial, looking now after 5 years of TAM and after 5 years of letrozole, at another 5 years of letrozole, saw. That trial won't have enough patients to meet its endpoint if we only take patients coming off 5 years of letrozole from the study. So we're going to open it up to patients who were treated off study in a similar manner. And that's the kind of thing I'd love to be able to offer my patients, a study, if I'm going to do something that hasn't really been supported by a clinical trial.
I think the NSABP's got a study that's
going to They're going to look at the longer duration as well.
So until that study is available or you're participating in it, right now, do you approach it as an option to continue, or you just come in and say, you know, it's time to stop?
I think it's an option because I think we've only tested one duration and we haven't tested any other durations. And if they still have a high risk of recurrence, I think it's okay. We'll talk about what's going on with their bones and their lipids, which are the things I worry about most. And if those are doing okay, then I think it's okay to continue for a few years anyway till we get more data.
Do you think we'll ever see a study of 10 years of an AI versus 5 years of an AI followed by tamoxifen for 5 years?
That would be a huge number of patients in order to analyze that. I don't know of any that's in planning right now, but it's a good question.
Or it could be a third arm, could be 5 years of the AI. Yeah, theoretical study that'll never get done. But kind of, I remember Ken Osborne brought that up a couple years ago as that type of a strategy, but I guess it'll probably never be studied.
Well, you know, we based the bulk of our data on stopping tamoxifen at 5 years on a node-negative trial.
Right.
And there, low risk of recurrence, the toxicities add up. The ATOM and ATLAS trials, we should see reporting on in the next year or so.
And that's continuing versus stopping.
That's longer tamoxifen than 5 years in higher risk populations. We talked about it at the Oxford Overview in 2005, and for a variety of reasons, it's been kind of postponed to 2006 because of getting data in and HIPAA issues and all. So we showed up in 2005 and didn't have most of our data. But in 2005, we were told that we expected the data from the ATOM and ATLAS trial of longer durations of tamoxifen in higher risk patients.
So right now, when are you thinking we're going to see that?
I think we could see it within the year.
Is there another Oxford meeting scheduled?
Yes, in September of 2006.
Really?
They're having all the planning meetings now, so the steering committee is meeting regularly over the summer. And as long as we get the missing data, we had a couple big groups that for patient privacy issues, HIPAA issues, couldn't get their data in time last year. I think we've resolved that.
Any other sort of take-home points from ASCO you want to comment on?
Well, I think the whole molecular profiling, genomic profiling is where we're headed. And I don't know that there was anything truly practice changing, but there were some things that really, I think, were the basis for studies that it would be needed. Dan Hayes looked at the CLGB9344 trial of AC plus or minus paclitaxel, did some HER2 staining, and it suggested that the majority of the benefit for adding the taxane was in HER2 positives. We'd previously seen a similar analysis with ER in that same trial suggesting that it was the ER positives who all benefited. So although I don't think it's any one factor per se, and that's where molecular profiling comes in. You know, even with the 21-gene recurrence score assay, Oncotype DX, you can look at 16 cancer-related genes that kind of magnify pathways, the HER2 and the ER pathway, as well as proliferation pathways and all. And that's probably going to be better than any one marker alone. So I think we're going to get better at predicting response to therapies and picking therapies that match the profile better. And we're already seeing some hints of that. We also have some prognostic markers. You know, UPA-PI1, which the Europeans have been presenting for a while, is a nice prognostic marker. The problem is the assay can't be done on anything but frozen tissue right now. But we're even designing therapies looking at impacting that pathway. So genomic profiling leading to better choosing patients for therapy, as well as identifying some targets for therapy, important targets that are leading the cancer to be able to survive and metastasize.